back to Projector Room, our fortnightly podcast where we talk about film, cinema, TV, all that crap I normally go through. Gareth and Alan are with me once more, gentlemen, for show 199. You know what that means, don't you?
Next one will be 200, if my math serves.
Well done, Alan. Are you past the test?
Good. Sit at the front of the class.
200th show next on the next one. And
wow,
it will reflect shows since 2016 when we started. So nearly 10 years. Hello, Gareth. Are you there?
Holy moly.
Yes, 10 years. That's more time than 5 years.
Guys, time well spent. That's horrifying. Mm. My gosh, that is
we're all boring. A bit older, chubbier, and grayer.
Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. What can you do? It's the march of time.
And I'm less good at talking about films.
That's a bit worrying. When we started this, I was 52. Good grief.
The Smokerolos.
But wow. You're 73 now.
Right, on with show 199. It's the 10th of December. And yes, watch out for our Christmas special show, special 200th edition on Christmas Eve. We shall bring that to you the day before Santa slips up your, and we'll have something a little bit special for that show. So watch out for that one. But in the meantime, we shall carry on regardless. Projectorroom.co.uk is our website. And you can find all about what else we do at tedsalmon.com. And GarethMiles.com is where you'll find Gareth. And apart from that, it's all in the MeWe group. The MeWe, I took the challenge last week from last show and watched Geostorm. And it's completely bonkers. You were quite right. I'm strangely compelling viewing, though, and really fun to watch. The whole plot line is just completely ludicrous. It's like some James Bond plot on steroids. But there's a great cast, I have to agree. And I also agree with you that Gerard Butler really is a very good leading man. Anything I see him in, I don't really want to agree with you on this, but I kind of do. he's a really good, star for your film, for one's film, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah,
he is. Yeah, the Jared burger. You know, you always love a good burger. Might not be the best thing for you, but yeah, it worked.
Yeah,
so smothered in cheese.
So I enjoyed that. Okay, Gareth. Irfan Ali is first up.
He is, and Irfan has watched a little film called Eve of Destruction from 1991, and he says, caught this blast from the past on Tubi last night. I used to see trailers on the VHS films I used to rent, but I never got around to watching it. You have a tap-dancing Gregory Hines, good on you, Gregory Hines, in pursuit of a state-of-the-art robot Eve 8, who has gone off-program. He has to stop her from killing innocents and reducing New York to a pile of rubble. In the bargain, Rene Sotendjik,
well done,
who plays the dual role of Eve 8 and the doctor who created her, was very nice to look at. The premise is nothing new, but I did find it quite enjoyable. It's a 6 out of 10 from Irfan. Yes, thank you, Irfan. Eve of Destruction is a corker of a movie. It's a very underappreciated film. It is a bit trashy. It's kind of that sort of a direct-to-video 90s schlock that you would expect, but it's a wee bit better than average. And
is it Shannon Tweed-tastic?
Oh, no, it doesn't go that way. Okay. Alan, I think you would like it because it's a 90s sci-fi film that does good stuff.
No, it does sound really good, yeah.
You can always rely on Gregory Hines for, a quality performance. He was Running Scared with Billy Crystal and some dancing movies because he's a dancer by trade.
Oh, yes, yeah. He's a really cool-looking dude, Gregory Hines with the sleepy eyes. I don't think I've seen that, so that would be one to look out for indeed. I'm just carping a quick look here. the trailer, which has a big egg-headed lady with no skin on her arm, which I think is a great place to start any date. And then, yeah, she's being rebooted into... And Gregory Hines, what a mush. Didn't he pass away recently?
He did, yes. We lost him.
Yeah. I think he was in our Final Curtain relatively lately. Anyway, it also has a splendid red leather jacket, so that is a must to revisit that.
And it's free to watch on TV, then.
Yeah, good. Thanks for the heads up on that, then.
Have you ever heard of it?
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Okay.
It doesn't have Ted.
We have some Bluetooth delays. Alan. Right. Over.
We don't.
Coming in, Ted. Over. I think it's over to you, just to see if this is your cup of tea. I'm guessing it's not.
I hadn't even looked at it, to be honest. Having looked at the thing rolling like you did just now, Alan, it looks very. It looks very 90s. I think Gareth's right.
Yeah.
You've got to look at the leading lady's hairdo, and you can just see it's like it's just 90s. Yeah,
I think it would be an enjoyable romp with chums, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure it would be good fun. Over.
Cool beans. Thank you, number one. You don't miss a thing, do you? Even if I'm juking a quick look at a link here on the sly, you do not miss
told me.
A thing.
You told me.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, so that's true. I did, didn't I? Right, so to climb out of this particular hole, we have to thank a couple of reviews coming up. We have A House of Dynamite 2025. It's a Netflix film, 1 hour and 52 minutes long. And this is a sort of Gemini summary. Then we're going to hear a little bit from Chad and Adrian shortly thereafter as well. But the Gemini summary of House of Dynamite is as follows. A single unattributed intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, is detected heading toward America. Officials have less than 20 minutes before impact. The film's structure is split into three overlapping segments, showing the same 18-minute window from the perspectives of different key players. Oh, yes, I heard about this recently. So the operators, White House Situation Room Senior Officer Captain Olivia Walker, played by the splendid Rebecca Ferguson, and the missile defense crew in Alaska, led by Major Daniel Gonzalez, by Anthony Ramos, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, who attempt and fail to intercept the incoming missile with ground-based interceptors, GBIs. It's acronym central here. The advisors, Deputy National Security Advisor Jake Barrington, played by Gabriel Basso, who advocates for restraint, and the hawkish General Anthony Brady, by Tracy Letts from Stratcom, who urges an immediate massive retaliatory strike. So he sounds a bit reminiscent of the character in How I Learned to Love the Bomb, the Kubrick film. If you remember, Dr. Strangelove. There's a fantastic character who's absolutely doolally in that. The decision maker, the unnamed president of the United States, none other than Idris, who must weigh the catastrophic options for response, including initiating a nuclear counterstrike against unknown or unconfirmed adversaries, with only minutes on the clock, with no clear confirmation of who launched the missile, Russia, China, or North Korea are possibilities, or whether it was deliberate or accidental, the decision makers face an impossible choice that could lead to full-scale global nuclear war. And the director is Catherine Bigelow, her of the Hurt Locker, and what else did she do? It's very acclaimed.
She is Near Dark.
Right.
And Zero Dark 30.
Right. And didn't she do Cold Steel way, way back with Jimmy Lee Curtis? Blue Steel, that's right. Yeah, that was a cracking movie as well. And the writer is Noah Oppenheim, and it stars Idris Elba, Rebecca Ferguson, Gabriel Basso. So, yes, I have heard things about this, but first let's go to Chad and Adrian. Chad says, it was a decently gripping plot, but I had a few questions about some of the protocols used and decisions that were being made, especially from the team based in Alaska. Good performances from everyone concerned, and the ending definitely made one think. Adrian chips in with. I think the broad concept was that in the situation, the protocols and mechanisms function as well as can be expected. But as you move up the food chain through the three iterations in the film, things become more chaotic with less competence and responsibility taken. Ordinarily, I like Catherine Bigelow's films, but this felt somewhat weak. Rebecca Ferguson, Idris Elba playing against type, and Jared Harris, whom we love, were great though. So, Ted, you have seen this. Thank you, Adrian and Chad and Gemini. So, Ted, what are your thoughts on this?
I saw it yesterday, knowing that we were going to talk about it today. And I thought to myself, I'd do my homework so I could chip in. And I really liked it. My dad watched it as well. My dad said when he'd watched it, we didn't watch it together. He told me that he just found the whole thing really confusing.
Right.
But I don't think he realized that it was an overlaid structure. So the first 20 minutes of the film were 20 minutes in real time, if you like. And then the second portion and the third portion were just going back and seeing that same portion of time from the other key players, as you previously described, Alan. But I thought it hung together really, really well. It was really tense, and I found myself on the edge of my seat, almost literally, eyes wide, and just transfixed with the whole process. I thought it was really well done. It was well directed and well shot and well acted by everyone. And as I say, just completely gripping and kind of scary. Like Chad said, when it comes to the end and you see the outcomes, or I won't spoil any of the outcomes or non-outcomes, but it's some of it is left to one's imagination and intelligence to kind of work out. But I think it was just done brilliantly well. I really, really enjoyed it and thought it was really good cinema if one watched it at the cinema with a Netflix film. Really, really good. Recommended viewing, I would say, for everyone. But don't go into it blind in terms of not understanding the overlay of time, particularly if you're 89 like my dad.
Oh. And your dad would have remembered the Cuba incident, things like that. Did he talk about that at all?
No, he didn't actually.
In view of it? No. Right. No. Okay.
But he did kind of say he enjoyed it. It's just that he just got lost because he didn't understand the structure of the film. He's used to seeing a film in chronological order and it just confused him completely. I should have watched it. I should have watched it with him really. But when I explained to him what was what, he almost said, well, I'll watch it again then, but I'm not quite sure he would. Gareth, what have you heard?
I've seen A Fistful of Dynamite, which isn't in any relation whatsoever to this at all.
Yes. And you've heard?
I also had a Dynamite Ducks on my computer once.
It's obviously now you're talking to him religion. Today. Have you had some sort of, have you been drinking?
No. I'll tell you later in the show. Okay. But carry on. Please carry on.
All right. Well, we'll leave that one behind then. House of Dynamite, recommended viewing. It's on Netflix at the moment, and it's a film, and it's nearly 2 hours long, and the time will fly. I guarantee it to you lovely people. Last up in this section is Robert McCrowan, who's been watching Stranger Things, which is something we keep coming back to over the nearly 10 years of our... In fact, yeah, look at that. This Stranger Things began in 2016, the year our podcast started. So no wonder we keep coming back to it. The final season of Stranger Things, he says, has finally arrived. It's been a long wait, and the children are all now grown up, not surprising, 10 years later, which is reflected in their behaviour and language. Given the gap, I struggled to catch up. But by episode 3, says Robert, I was back on board. We have lots of creepy scenes, violence, a brutal secret unit of the US Army, and another mad scientist. So what's not to like? It's an enjoyable watch, and I'm looking forward to seeing how they round it all up. So, thank you, Robert. Like I said last time we spoke about Stranger Things on Projector Room, I watched half of the first series and got kind of fed up with it and then went back to it. And I need to go and start it again and give it another go, because clearly it's very popular and I'm the odd bod and the odd one out not watching it.
I remember a time when smoking was popular. It didn't make it good for you. So, I mean, I watched the first season of it and lapped it up and thought it was really wonderful and would still stand by that. But I got fairly bored with the second season, and I don't think I even watched the third one. Or it may have been that the second one was okay and I hated the third one. But anyway, I just couldn't be dragged to this under any circumstances.
Right, fair enough.
That I can repeat here. You know, enough already.
I have to say that the only reason I started watching it really was because Winona Ryder was in it.
Yeah, fair balls.
You know, I really like her as an actor, actress.
Yes.
So there you go. Gareth, have you seen anything of this? Have you stopped drinking yet?
No, I checked out halfway through season two thinking this is a load of cat.
Okay.
I never went back to it. But I understand that people are very, very enthusiastic about it. It's quite imaginative. It's a big budget, glossy show. And I would never deprive them of that. I think that, yeah, long may it continue, even though it's come to an end. But it gave people something interesting to watch.
Did you enjoy the first season? Like you said, you watched the first season, but were you quite gung-ho about it, or just like it was just there?
It was just there. It's one of those sort of sci-fi horror things that you know you've seen better if you do your research and do your work. And this kind of, it covers some ground that you've seen before, and you're like, well, I've done that and I've done that. But
It was nice to watch a show where you liked the characters and you were sort of empathizing for them and hoping that they were okay, which was the case in the first season. I think I liked all the characters. And the villains and things were interesting and motivated. He was really, really good. Yeah, he's
and then Paul
always
Reiser
good.
In second.
Yeah. Who's always good as well. Yeah. But it seemed to get really formulaic and like, let's just shoehorn more, you know, content around this brand as it progressed. And then I think also recently then there was allegations about David Harbour, who was a character who I really liked in the first season. And as I say, these are just allegations, but all those sort of rumor mill stuff does sour the milk a bit, I think. And, you know, so I don't know. Anyway, it's not for me.
Fair enough. Okay. And talking of Stranger Things, I took the challenge for Flop of the Fortnight here. I took the challenge and watched Silent Hill, which we spoke about on the last show. Not the new one, because the new one's not out yet, but the 2006 one. And I'm afraid, Gareth, that I just found it slow, dull and boring for the most part. And when it does leap into action, the creations that are around the characters are not particularly scary or horrific at all. It seemed to come across very much like a PC game, which is probably obvious that it would do. And it just felt like it was the creation of some spotty teenage boys in their bedrooms, given a CGI machine or in these days a Google VO3 machine, and just said go and let your creativity go wild in your imagination. Some of the kind of scary creatures and things crawling around were a little bit scary, I suppose, but it just didn't do anything for me. And I watched the whole thing. I really did. So there's your bit of feedback. I did try.
Well, fair dues. Yeah, it's not for everyone. I know my wife wasn't particularly chuffed with it, but I guess because I've played one of maybe two of the games back in the day, it was nice to see it all kind of fully come to the screen. Also, it's that kind of, it's obviously ropey. It was very heavily the heavy use of CGI from 2006 doesn't translate too well today because it just isn't convincing. But back in 2006, you hadn't seen anything quite like it, so you know it worked. Whereas now we look back and go, oh, flippers, like watching a sci-fi movie from the 1950s. It's not convincing. Although that would be slightly more convincing than this. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, I gave it a go. So there. Private screenings next. And I had this idea on the last show of doing some shorts, as you will remember. And I sent everyone off to do their bit of homework and come up with two shorts each, mostly from YouTube, because the shorts seem to be readily available on YouTube. And I thought there were some great ideas that came out of this. We're going to abandon the scoring on this one, because it's going to be a bit impossible to keep the same formula going. But consider this a week out of that.
Well, Ted, can I contest that controversially?
Okay.
You're a good spud. What if we can say what we think, we can score them, but they'll not just be entered into the league table?
Oh, okay. Yeah, we're fine. Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
And then we can have a good old scrap about, no, it was brilliant, no, it was rubbish.
Okay, you start then, Alan. We can do the rubbish first.
All right. Okay, so Concrete, which is a 2024 YouTube short by a brand called Dust, who do is sort of like they're a channel that do sci-fi exclusively. It's a 15-minute movie. It stars Ed Harris, no less. Mm-hmm. terrific stuff, terrific actor. And it's a science fiction short about a psychotic man who... So the premise of the thing is the usual dystopian Orwellian concrete jungle. Everybody is forced to wear these or be implanted with pineal gland chips. So essentially, you know, like the mark of the beast put into the forehead where the third eye would be if you're into esoteric literature or the, you know, all that kind of new age stuff. So, yeah, right in the middle of the forehead, there's a sort of pinpoint of technology that's stapled into your brain and links you into the Matrix, baby. And this fellow manages
pineal gland
to
or something,
yeah, the pineal gland, yeah, that's right. And so this guy is very concerned about his mum, who doesn't seem to be getting fed properly by a machine which sploops out regurgitated porridge into people and keep them alive while they watch regurgitated TV on old broken televisions. It's like a, you know, Chris Cunningham music video from the early 2000s. It's bleak, baby. So he calls out some repair person to fix the kind of interface in their flat. And in so doing, he bumps into like a rogue agent who pulls the pineal implant out of his skull, and then he goes into a sort of psychotic breakdown where he meets Ed Harris, appropriately enough, in a tent in the basement of the tenement building. And Ed is like a sort of who was that shaman guru who did Timothy Leary type kind of guy, and he philosophizes with him about, you know, what is the nature of reality and what is illusion. So I'm none the wiser at the end of watching it. I thought it was well made, but pretentious, indulgent cobblers, really. A bit self-important and sophomoric, but it was well made and with some good performances. What did you guys think? So I'm going to give it 4 out of 10.
Yeah,
what do you chaps think?
I think I'll give it 4 as well. It is a kind of futuristic idea, as you say, AI robots, yeah, not being able to tell the difference, information overload, some messages going out about that, and what's real and what's imagined. I'm not really sure I understood the full message, to be honest, other than taking the story at face value, I suppose. But it's great that, you know, you mentioned Ed Harris here. I think it's great, yeah, that people like him are prepared to give a leg up to filmmakers in this kind, yep, of way. And if you look at YouTube, Dust is a really big channel on YouTube, and there's loads and loads of short films on there by all sorts of filmmakers, up and coming and established as well. And there seems to be, like, on a daily basis, new films put up on there. It's really worth looking at.
Do they commission work? Are you aware? Are they like a sort of YouTube channel type thing that would commission? Right, yeah. It'd be interesting to see, like, is there a financial model for that? Anyway, and what did you think, Gareth?
Well, I have a thing about some short films that run over 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I think I start to get a bit, is this ever going to end? You know, this is supposed to be short. It should be done by now. I know that sounds ridiculous, given that it's only 15 minutes.
But I can relate to it, yeah.
I feel it should be shorter. And this started to meander halfway through. And I was hoping that it was over. I did enjoy the premise, but I think it's because whenever a short film starts to get a wee bit longer, you kind of wish that, you know, you're not wanting to invest yourself too much in the world because it could be over very, very soon. Mm-hmm. And you know, whenever it comes to an end, you're like, right, well, that's that universe over with. Let's move on with our lives. Whereas if you invest too much in it, then, you know, you feel a bit shortchanged by the end of it.
Yeah.
If it had been a 19-minute movie, I think I would have identified with this a lot more.
Yes, I agree.
I did want to see more into this world and have a better idea, a better grip of what was going on and what this little addition to your cranium does for you.
Yeah. Let you finish.
No, far away. On that note.
Well, I think if you'd had the 90 minutes, then you could have explored things like, is it the same actor playing the mother as the lead? Mm. And also, what is the little girl at the beginning? And then why does he become a guy in a dress halfway through? And so all those are things that at this, you know, like at a 15-minute film with all the other stuff going on and all the psychobabble, I couldn't give a monkey's ass about. But if it was done at 90 minutes and you felt you had some investment in the characters, then you might want to stick around in the hope that the film would give you some actual insight or revelation or catharsis for that. My suspicion would be that they're just throwing a ton of ideas at it and hoping something will stick, because I didn't think there was any. I don't want to just be left with questions, you know.
But isn't that part of what shorts are about? So often we see films that are picked up by other filmmakers and it comes up and it's based on this short from so-and-so in, you know, 20 years ago.
True.
Ideas are thrown out there, and it could be that in 10 years' time someone has done the 90-minute thing of this.
I think that's absolutely spot on, Ted, yeah. And, you know, I suppose it's just knowing the portion size and what you can get away with. So it couldn't feasibly wrap all those things up in that time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there we go. Anyway, the second one then is perhaps...
Gareth hasn't scored.
Oh, I beg your pardon, Gareth. He's going to take his... It's a free kick.
I have one more thing to add about it as well. Yeah. The actual plot of this is essentially Mind Warp from 1992, the Fangoria movie that was made. It's the same idea where they're plugged into this alternate world and they get curious about what's outside of it and expanding your mind, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Dark City was brilliant that way as well.
Yes,
that's a smashing movie. Very, very underrated. Mm-hmm.
I suppose even The Matrix, I guess.
Of course, The Matrix, yeah. That was the set text, isn't it?
Yeah, but I'm going to go
anything
above.
By Philip K. Dick.
Yes, that's true. But I'm going to go above you guys, and I'm going to give it a big whopping 5.
Gosh.
Because I was probably the most critical about it, I really did enjoy it in the end, whenever I eventually got through it. But the 15 minutes did feel too long, and it would have been so much nicer had it been just shaved down to 10, like most of the rest of the films that come out.
Right, cool beans. So then next up, I think this was a better sort of portion size given our comments on Concrete. And this is Big Take. It's linked in the show notes. 2024 short. Interestingly, it's only 4 minutes, and it was shot on 16mm. Which is a lovely thing to do. It's nice to go back and see that format being used. And I have to say, being used absolutely beautifully. Very, very modest little vignette of a burglar on the loose. And he's running to escape the police, hides in a basement where he finds another burglar or sort of petty criminal. And they exchange a sort of knowing look and a couple of moments of tension as the police congregate just outside the basement. During that time, they have a quick cigarette together, and then the moment has passed and they have to respectively continue their escape from the police. But the fellow who had the cigarette, the lighter, finds that the other guy has swiftly taken his nice collectible Zippo in the midst of their little exchange.
Spoiler alert.
It's a Spoiler alert, yes, indeed. So it's a very, very simple, constrained little story. And I thought it was beautifully made, really, really snappy, professional cinematography, edit, sound design, very, very capably acted, no dialogue. It was kind of, it was just a terrific Hollywood short film calling card. It knew just how much to bite off and did a great job, in my estimation. Ted, what did you think?
I would agree. I think that the strength of this was probably, and I thought you would say this, about the fact that it was shot on a film. Now, to be honest, I'm not knowledgeable enough about movie films and 16mm to know the difference. And the only thing that I would observe about it is that it didn't look particularly sharp to me. And I guess that's the difference between film and digital, is it?
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's it. It had a lovely colour grade. You know, the saturation in the colour was lovely and bright and warm. And, you know, and it was evenly graded across the whole thing. But I think that's exactly the main distinction between film, is that it's got just a slightly more suffused, softer look. And digital can be a bit too crisp and sharp.
Yeah.
It seems a little brittle on the eyes sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was a nice little story, though. I quite enjoyed it for what it was, and made a little point in there. And the whole thing about theft, as everyone's as bad as each other. And
absolutely.
It was quite nice.
Yes, that's right. There's a little moral or a little punchline in it as well, wasn't there?
Yeah.
From that point of view, what would you give it in terms of a score? Or shall we hear from Gaz first?
Yeah, let's hear from Gazza.
All right, Gaz, over to you, mate.
This is more along the lines of what I love from a short is I always like to think of a short as a joke. You know, if you've got a comedy, it's just a setup and a punchline. And that's what this did. And it did it effectively and beautifully. And it looks lovely on 16mm because it's a format that we don't see very often anymore. And I think the filmmakers have made a good choice in going back and resurrecting that sort of thing, because it just has that extra volume to it that makes it more filmy without being 35. I really enjoyed this, and I got a bit of a kick out of the punchline, which isn't hilarious, but it's enough to make you go, although I did see it coming. I prefer this over Concrete greatly. And it kept my attention for the entire 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm. You know what? But if I'm honest with you, Gareth, I was starting to wish Concrete was over well before the halfway mark. So my attention span for that movie, or I think it was just like, oh, here we go again. I've seen this a million times. I'm not really in the mood sort of thing. And what was nice about Big Take was it's all cinema. It's all, there's no dialogue. There's none of this kind of portentous, what is life, what is reality nonsense. It's just a beautifully observed and very, very well executed little moment of movie interaction. I thought it was great. So, Ted, what are you going to score it?
I'm going to give it 6. Gareth?
7.
Okay.
And I'm going to top that with an 8.
Which is 21, I think, isn't it? 8 and 7.
I didn't think about it. Maybe the running time of Concrete was actually extended whenever they got Ed Harris, and they thought, we can't have him there for 2 minutes. Let's have him there for 6.
Totally. And at one point I thought, oh my gosh, did they only get him for the opening voiceover? And you know, that's why it's, you know, starring Ed Harris for the 2 sentences that he phoned in, literally. But no, he does give a terrific performance there.
I remember I went to see I think it was like a Red News Day type thing or some sort of comedy thing with Catherine Ryan. She was in this short film about cats and the FBI or the CIA developing a cat listening device.
And by the way. That's not just a joke.
It is. It's based on the true story, and what happened to the cat. But I remember going to see it because it said Jeff Faye was in it. I was like, brilliant. Fantastic. Right. It's 15 minutes long. I'll be able to sit down and watch a bit of Jeff Faye here. And he did a voiceover of American in it. I was like, is that it? Balls.
That cat was actually observed on the grassy knoll on November the 23rd or 22nd, 1973. 1963. Oh, really? Yeah. No. I know I am a conspiracy nut, but I draw the line.
Well, because it was such in the 60s, I thought, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. But they were doing all sorts of things. They were putting putting some mixture into Castro's drink so that his beard would fall out, and he would lose credibility with the public. And then they were trying to give him exploding cigars and things. These are all, you know, actual CIA plots. And I think there was about 100 attempts to kill the guy. And some of them utterly bizarre, you know, like that.
Right. Okay. The first one of mine is called Cope, and it's on YouTube. It's 7 minutes long, and it's a very simple story about this guy who we open up looking at his life and following him around, and he says he's got 6 weeks to live. We look at the calendar, and he's got a circle on the date in 6 weeks' time. And we just follow him around, and he narrates what he's doing, and he comes across as being possibly depressed or looking for something. And there's a kind of punchline at the end in which it gives the kind of basis of the end of the story, which is not quite what it seems. And I don't want to give it away because people might want to spend 7 minutes of their life looking at this. It's written and directed by Anthony Sutcliffe, and it has got some actors in it who have been in television and stuff, so it's not just kind of students or nobodies. These people are they've been on TV shows and stuff. Nice little film, I thought, and it was just thoughtful reflections on life and staying alive. And one of the things that struck me about it most, which Gareth, I thought you might notice as well, is the super music. It was really nice music right throughout.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, this is quite a bit of an eye-opener. It was it really makes you think about who you might be talking to or who you're dealing with in the street. Obviously, it highlights mental health issues that are going to be hidden or obscured. And I think it's quite important, this film, actually, because it really makes you realize something that people do, people might do, people mm-hmm. that you don't realize do.
Yep.
I was very impressed with this. It's really well made. It's beautifully shot. It's beautifully scored. And I would give this a 8 or 9 out of 10. Probably wow. 8.
Actually. Cool. Alan?
Yes, I have nothing fresh to add to that. It was exceptionally well made. It was thought-provoking. It was convincing. So I would say 8. I mean, and that's probably modest given the accolades that the film has got.
So we're going to go for 23 here then, because I'm going to give it 7. So 8 and 8 and 7 is that right? 23? Yeah. Right, and my second one was Don't Look Away, which was a bit of a spook. The only downside of this, I thought, that the acting was shit. You could just see, unlike the first one, the Cope one, where it was clear that people were good at what they were doing, and it was really well produced. This was a really interesting idea that was going on here. This girl is in her suburban home and looks out the window, and there's this mysterious figure standing looking at her. And she calls her father, who's not in the house, and says, "What's going on? And do you know who this person is?" And Dad on the phone gets her to describe the figure and says to her, "Don't look away," and it's called Don't Look Away. Don't look away. So she's been told she's not allowed to look away. Doesn't know why. And he says, "Go and get your brother to go and lock all the doors and shut yourselves in." Of course, they don't follow the rules, and other things go wrong, and it starts to get a bit kind of tense, and there's a kind of unseen terror thing going on. And, this figure suddenly, because they don't do as they're told, or they don't do as Dad tells them what to do, it suddenly changes the whole thing, and some of them are seeing the figure in one place, some in another, and there's some kind of jump scares things going on and some spooky moments. I thought it was really nice. It was a little chiller spook thingy, but I didn't think it was too spooky for you, Alan. It was just like quite nicely spooky. Yeah, so I quite liked it. Giggle. I thought it was quite good. What did you think?
Well, I liked your note. Yes, definitely, it's not beyond Alan's coping level, which you know very well, and that's very, very accurate. I thought it was you're bang on there. It was a very good idea. The execution was pretty weak, but the idea was strong enough to still have a wee twinge of fear about it. I think it did have a nightmarish component to it, that the situation would escalate out of control very rapidly. And from the storytelling point of view, I thought it was a good idea, and it was a compelling predicament. But yeah, the acting did let it down, and some of the, you know, it was very thin in terms of visual style, if any, really. Yeah. It just looked like it was shot on a phone and things. But it's more important, I think, that you have an idea that gets under your skin, mm-hmm. which this certainly did have.
Or that someone else later, as we said earlier, will pick it up and run with it.
Yes, yeah, definitely. Which I think is the case with one of the other movies, but not this one. Is that right? I haven't seen anything to that effect.
No, I don't think so.
It's one of Gareth's choices later on. But Gareth, what did you think of this?
Well, I quite enjoyed this. Again, it was it's that kind of set up on a punchline. It delivers fairly much a full-blooded horror narrative that has a bigger, deeper plot line that could be explored in a feature film. But in this way, it still has more of a deeper plot line than some of the Friday the 13th movies. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I didn't have any issues really with the acting. They were, you know, obviously not Scarlett Johansson, but they could well be one day. My one problem was that I don't think it ended particularly well. I don't think the gag at the end was particularly well explained, or, you know, is it something that they're going to develop on, or is there going to be Don't Look Away 2, which is another 8 minutes long? No, more than likely it was just they didn't quite know how to finish it, but they came up with a great idea and didn't flesh it out fully. And the makeup effects as well were particularly good too, which
The monster was pretty good, wasn't
enjoyable.
It?
Yeah.
They managed to get a sort of signature look for the paranormal being, which a lot of people just don't really manage to handle. I think that you can sort of see that as the as an iconic kind of horror figure.
True. The nice black suit and things like that. Kind of, I think that maybe took away from it. Whereas something the head was well done. And mm-hmm. if you think about, well, obviously I can't talk about this with you, Alan, because you're mm-hmm. a big girl's blouse. But mm-hmm. True. Like Jeepers Creepers or Diced or something like that. Mm-hmm. You need a proper scary creature like this, or even It Follows would be something similar to this, and where you end up seeing what it is. It's pamp wettingly scary, whereas this isn't terribly, but it's enough to be able to play daily on TV or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Score.
Yeah.
Six.
All right, I'm giving it 7. 6 and 6 is 19, isn't it? Is that right? Yeah,
I think so. I give it 6 as well.
Okay.
Yeah, good.
So you're going to give it 6, and it is 19, Right, okay, Gareth, over to you.
The first one I went, which is... Sorry, Alan?
No, sorry. Ted is right. 6 and 6 and 7 is 19.
Oh, good.
Good. Right, okay. Calculator away. This one is called Technical Support. It's from 2023, and it's a wee bit of a joke film about a guy who orders a a sex robot, and it malfunctions whilst he's trying to use it, and he fears for his life and has to go through.
I love the brief pause there. He tries to use it. Good answer.
He has to go through the helpline, which kind of means the film is now showing its age, because bloody helplines don't exist anymore. You have to go online bots. Yeah. But
online bots, but anyway, sorry. I couldn't leave it. Yeah.
But I thought this was rather well done, fairly funny, and the person at the end of the helpline. I thought she was the star of the show here. And I do think the last gag, the big joke at the very end was well worth waiting for as it went through. I was quite impressed by this. What did you guys think, Tedley Deadly?
I thought it was really, really funny, and it was really well script, well written. And I loved it when they went to the health centre. The camera went along all the girls sat completely uninterested, and you caught a glimpse of what they were saying to their punters on the phone. And one of them said, "And is your penis stuck in her ear?" And it was just that creased me up hearing that going on. And then eventually we get to our help agent, who's stuffing crisps and eating drinks and completely uninterested and behaving like a bot. In fact, you know, her responses were all canned responses. Everything she said to the guy who was in trouble, the guy that was in trouble had to repeat things all the time because she was behaving just like a bot would. And it was done really, really interestingly. So,
would you care to take a moment and give us some feedback?
Yeah, exactly. It was really funny. The whole thing was really funny. It was good comedy, and it was just the right length of time. And, the girl that played the robot did it very well. I mean, you could obviously see she was human, but it was done really well throughout. I really enjoyed that. So, yes, an 8 from me. Alan?
I agree with you both. I thought it was very funny. It was well written. It was very well performed. Comedy is very difficult to do, and I think the fella in particular really, really nailed the comic reactions and anticipation without over-egging it. It's a difficult sort of thing to get just in the right ballpark, I think, you know, because it wasn't like sort of Charlie Chaplin style, kind of really over the top. But it was also pretty broad, you know, situational comedy. So, yes, I agree with everything you said. For me, it was maybe a little bit too long, but the payoff at the end was very funny. So I would give it a 7.
So that's 23 as well. Okay.
Grand. All right. Well, the second one I have is a little horror outing, and I was a bit concerned about it going into it because I thought, oh, Ted's not going to like this, but I think
Alan will be scared.
yes, true.
Ted will be scared.
We're here to challenge ourselves, aren't we? Portrait of God is about a painting where, or no, it's a picture that a person puts up on a projector, and it is of a portrait of God where. Most people see nothing, but people have reported seeing something. And the girl who's kind of investigating it in a way, she looks at it and sees something as the film goes on. It's only 7 minutes long, but I thought it was a good build up, and then it gives you a nice and fairly spooky climax. Yeah. Ted? I wonder about you.
I'm just, as you predicted, I'm just annoyed because of all the constant references to bloody religion. But I do think that about halfway through, when when she started to be able to see the spooky figure, I thought that was done really well, and it was just in enough darkness and shadow to be spooky and horrible, not too dark so you couldn't make out enough of it. It was just done perfectly well, and you know, the image and the eyes, and I don't want to give too much away, but that was really creepy, and it was good, and for that I'll give it my 3 points. I'm taking everything else away because of the religion.
Right, it was a really good movie aside from the religion, so
yeah, bloody right.
okay. Well, I thought initially, oh my gosh, this is ponderous, pretentious, uncinematic nonsense. As the first couple of minutes it's just, you know, a locked off shot of a woman, you know, a young woman, a student essentially, talking out loud about, you know, the big questions: is there a God, and if so, why is there suffering? You know, and I thought, please don't let this be the whole movie. And then, of course, it gets going and it became freaking terrifying, both in the execution and how well it did the actual, the filmic aspect of it. The visuals were really good. But what was also really scary was like the implication, because as the visuals slowly reveal, then there's this sort of creeping dread of like, well, what if a loving God was actually monstrous in some shape or form? So, and I thought also the punchline of the thing was really scary as well. But it was that kind of collywobbles thing of just some of an idea just starting to sink in. And there was no sort of jarring kind of jump scares or anything like that. It was a well thought through, sort of philosophically disturbing and very, very well executed short film. And it was horrible and creepy, as it should be as a horror film. And that is the one, Gareth, that's been taken up, I think, by Sam Raimi to make into a feature, or maybe it was Ted who was saying earlier about some of these things do get. Yeah, I think Sam Raimi or somebody's picked up on the idea and supporting the director in making a feature or something along those lines. So, yeah, no, it was very, very well judged. People who have a talent for that kind of creepy horror are few and far between. And the other person that really has it is that young, unbelievably gifted 17-year-old guy who did all those backroom things in Blender on his computer. And like, he's now, I think, working on creating a big franchise of that. But those are astoundingly well made and unbelievably technically difficult, but they're so fresh, so distinct, and so eerie in a way that nobody else that I am aware of ever created horror. And he's like a Mozart, in my view. You know, he's just like a brilliant young genius, and he's just doing this stuff in his bedroom. And
In the back room.
Yeah, exactly. So there you go. That was an interesting one.
Score?
Yeah, okay. Score, yes. I give it 7.
Yeah, I give it scary, so I guess 8. It's supposed to be a scary film when it was 8, and it was scary. I didn't like the sentiment of it, but it was. That's not what we're here to market for.
From what we've learned so far, if you don't like something about it, you mark it down. Like, what religion? Take off 8 points.
Yeah, but I do respect. Isn't you know he doesn't beat around the bush. What was the one you gave 0 to, Ted? Because for some reason
I can't remember. Oh, actually, I think I marked it, didn't I? Oh yeah, there we go. Yeah. Patang Yang Kipper Bang.
It's a blooming lovely movie, and you were like, you nuked it.
I didn't hear what you scored for this last one, Alan.
So I'm at 8.
8. Right, okay, yeah. So that gives that a score of 18. So we've got a tie for first place, Alan, with our unofficial scoring between the comic sex doll technical support thingy, Liam, who has only got 6 weeks to live with the lovely music. Aww. So they've both got 23.
Well, could I recommend that he gets a sex bot and just spends the last 6 weeks wisely?
Good idea. Right, okay. Now, last thing to do in this section is to get Gareth to tell us what to be watching for the next show.
All right. Well, I couldn't believe my eyes whenever I happened to notice that it was actually on YouTube, because I've spent the years trying to find a little film called Dead Man's Letters. And it turns out it's on YouTube all this time. I've been trying to track down DVDs and videos and things, but I finally found it's from a director called Constantine Lepush. I can't remember his last name. But Lepush, it's there, isn't it? I'll click here. Lepushansky. And this is a Russian sci-fi, or Russian post-apocalyptic sci-fi depression fest.
Panic.
It is, yes, I promise you. It's something that we've never done before. And if you liked Stalker, that will be a field day. Can compared to this. Although I haven't seen it, so I'm breaking new wind here, and I hope you gentlemen enjoy it.
Okay, then. So there it is, Dead Man's Letters, 1986. If you can get hold of it or watch it on YouTube, then let us know what you think of that before the next show. Theme treats. I chose Jonathan Demme, if that's how you say it, because the only thing that I knew of his that was outrageously brilliant and just my film of forever was The Silence of the Lambs. So I should avoid doing that because we've spoken about that so often and we could make 5 whole shows about the stuff that's in there. So I challenged myself to watch a different one, which I'd never heard of, and it was made in 1979. It's called The Last Embrace. A government agent recovering from a nervous breakdown deciphers a death threat written in an ancient language, and it stars Roy Scheider and Janet Margolin. Janet Margolin, Alan, you will know from Annie Hall.
She
played the character Robin in fact she was the first wife or the second wife of what's his name? Alvin? No.
Alvin. Janet Margolin, yeah.
And she played the first wife that wouldn't have sex with him.
Oh yeah, and he was obsessed with the Kennedy assassination, oddly enough, in that scene, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So anyway, I watched Last Embrace, and I have to agree, now Gareth, I know, because I spoke to him off air, I didn't plan this, but this is something that he can talk about as well, so that's really good, because it'll help me out. But Roy Scheider really is another good leading man, and I hadn't really realised. He doesn't have the particular looks with his wonky nose of being a leading man, but he actually carries it off. He's not just about Jaws, and he plays the lead in this almost Hitchcockian thriller. I think there's lots about it that is very, it feels very Hitchcockian about this guy who gets this note and he has to piece together what's going on around him, deciphering the message, and it turns out that it's a death threat, and that there's racing around to get to play. It's very, very Hitchcock, very kind of early, well, you know,
classic sort of Hitchcock.
Yeah, it's a really, really good film, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I had no idea that the same guy that directed this was also responsible for Silence of the Lambs. So, Gareth, fill in the gaps, please.
I could try. It has been a long time since I've seen it. I have it on Blu-ray, actually, now I think about it. But, yes, I really enjoyed this as well. I blazed through a whole load of Roy Scheider films because I decided he was the greatest for a few years, and went and tracked down everything I could. And then as I was watching this, I remembered there was Charles Napier and Christopher Walken and Joe Spinell.
Oh, yeah,
Christopher Walken. Mandy Palakin's in there as well. Yeah, they're it's a phenomenal cast. But I don't remember the story particularly well, and there's nothing that really stood out to me. And to be entirely honest, I thought that I had seen it before that time I watched it, because I remember a particular shot that was in it from a bell tower looking down, and he's walking around in a light suit. And I don't know where I'd seen that before, because whenever I watched the whole movie, it was like, I don't remember any of this, except for that one shot.
It starts off in this.
According to IMDb, I gave it 7 out of 10 some years ago.
Right. It starts off in this restaurant, and there's a big shootout that goes on, and Roy Scheider is sat there with his wife, and his wife gets killed in this shootout. And then it goes on from there in terms of piecing together what's going on. He suddenly finds this piece of paper that's shoved under his door, I seem to remember, and it's a death threat. And then he has to try and work out who it is. And it turns out that a number of people have had these death threats, and he's the only one that is still alive, and he's trying desperately to race around and find out what the threat is about and who's made the threat and how to, you know, to sort it all out. And the bell tower scene at the end is great because he's having this shootout, and there's these bells going on around them, and there's this two guys with guns. One of them is him, and they're shooting up and down. It's a really good scene. It's really well choreographed, and it's so Hitchcock. Sorry, back to you.
No, that's it. That's all I have. I can't really add too much. It's been that long.
Okay.
I do need to watch it again.
Anyway, that was my pick, and I was pleased that I watched it. Do you know it, Alan?
I don't know, but I do share your enthusiasm for Roy Scheider.
Yes, indeed. So that was my pick, because I avoided Silence of the Lambs. What did you pick, Alan?
let me see. Sorry, what did I pick? Manchurian Candidate, the remake of the early Sinatra movie that had been banned. It's a cracking movie about a mind-programmed assassin who commits a political assassination, unaware that, in fact, it's another aspect of their alter ego has committed the crime. And very, very tense. Very accomplished remake with Denzel Washington in the lead and a female antagonist clearly modelled on Hillary Clinton, which is quite interesting, played by, I think it's Meryl Streep. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was really, really good. And the original Sinatra movie was fantastic as well. And it had, is it James Fox, I think, maybe?
Yeah.
Is it James Fox in it? It was another very urbane sort of English guy who was fantastic. Name will come to me anyway, I'll look it up. But that movie was banned for like 20 years because it did touch on some very, very unpleasant aspects of torture that the CIA were involved in. Lawrence Harvey, yeah, who's fantastic in that. But Sinatra's performance in it was absolutely phenomenal. This guy coming apart at the seams in that movie. So both versions, it's quite rare where both, you know, the original and the remake are outstanding. But I thought that it really held up very, very well indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Thoroughly enjoyable. Have either of you seen it?
The remake? No.
Oh, it's good.
Yeah.
Really.
I love the original, but I think it came out around about the time of the remake of Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3, and I was like, yeah. No, it could never be as good because Pelham was never as good.
That is one of the quintessential 70s crime movies. Such a bleak picture, isn't it?
Manchurian,
really tense.
The Manchurian Candidate, this is the one that you're highlighting here. Again, I had no idea that Jonathan Demme was involved. And I've seen this a couple of times over the years. But it's been a while since I last watched it. But looking at the thing rolling through in front of me, it's all coming back to me, yeah. And perhaps I should watch it again. Yeah, good pick.
Yeah, cheers, man. So what else have we got?
Gareth.
Well, my one's a very obvious one. Back in, I can't remember what it was, but I picked up Something Wild on VHS and watched it because I thought it looked like a crazy comedy. And I suppose in certain ways it is kind of a crazy comedy, but this is very much a film in two halves. And it was a film that actually changed the way I looked at films because I realized that you could switch things up halfway through and turn things into something else because it moves very quickly from, you know, a bit of a wacky comedy into a real psychological thriller. Whenever Ray Liotta's character comes in, Something Wild is absolutely superb, and it's the reason why Ray Liotta is one of my favorite actors, or one of the many reasons, I suppose, but it's one of the first times, aside from Goodfellas, that he really just appeared on screen, and I thought, wow, what an intense performance. And as a result, he kind of got typecast as that along over the years, because he did this so well, and then he sort of cemented it in Unlawful Entry, and then went on to do Turbulence as well, and be the only good thing about that.
Copland, his performance in Copland was phenomenal.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. He was so underrated in that film.
He was terrific in that.
took all of the limelight there. But this film, you know, Jeff Daniels, I think, is overlooked in this, even though he's the star of the film. Everyone went crazy about Melanie Griffith in this, and then obviously Ray Liotta stole the film away. But Jeff Daniels is such a solid lead here, and a really thankless role as well. And Demi just, I find this movie difficult to believe exists, because it is, on the one hand, first, just a typical comedy with little bits of drama throughout, and then it just turns on its heel into something so violent and scary that anyone who's in that predicament just, I don't think many people could manage. And whenever you see Jeff Daniels as useless sort of yuppie type being confronted with this, it really puts, it really gives a good character for a decent actor, you know, where something interesting happens for the character to really enjoy, or for the actor to really enjoy playing that character. Have either of you two seen this?
I don't think so.
No, I haven't seen it, but I'm watching the trailer roll through on IMDb as you were talking, and what strikes me is just how young everyone is, you know, all these actors. Well, mind you, it is nearly 40 years old now, so it's probably not surprising, but Ray Liotta, it's almost unrecognisable from recent roles.
This was his first film role as well.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and also Melanie Griffith, she just looks lovely, doesn't she?
She was so sexy, and earlier in her career, she really was gorgeous.
So I shall be looking this one out, certainly. So good pick again.
Oh, it is, and I think there's a really good Blu-ray of it out from Criterion, which delves into it, and it looks fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well worth picking an ad up.
Cool. Okay. Oh, one thing I forgot to mention about Last Embrace and Jonathan Demme was one of the shots that he made. Presumably, the cinematographer was involved in doing this as well as him. But there was a train coming into a platform, and you'd have to see it to appreciate what he was doing, I think. But the cameraman was told to run along or dolly along the platform or whatever, between the train and the pillars of the platform. And it's a really, really effective shot. I think, Alan, you'd really like that. If you can, watch the first 15 minutes of the film and track that scene down and just see what he's done with the camera work going along the platform. It's pretty simple. Oh, okay. But it's one of those things where you say to yourself, well, he really didn't need to do that, and most directors wouldn't have thought of doing it, but he did, and it worked really well. So I liked
it. The visual flourish.
I've learned a lot about Jonathan Demme this week from having looked at these and listening to you two as well. So
oh, bless you, sir.
One last thing to do, which is to choose a director for the next show, and it's Gareth's turn.
All right. Well, it's coming to the end of the year, and I think I actually joked about doing this some time ago, but then I thought, no, bloody well do it. And for those of you who know who he is, because I don't think too many people are going to recognize him straight away, but then whenever you do some Googling, you'll go, holy crap. Jess Franco. He's quite the filmmaker. And I would thoroughly recommend looking up some of his directorial outings as opposed to his acting outings or his writing outings. Go for a film directed by Jess Franco. Alrighty. Good luck, gentlemen.
Okay. Well, you have interesting challenge accepted.
Okay, we'll be back to talk about that on the next show. So thank you for that. And now we're going to move into the main.
You won't be speaking to me.
What?
You set the bar fairly low earlier on, you know, so we'll see, dude. What was the one that was all basically sort of vixen porno? Was it Russ Meyer or somebody?
There's Russ Meyer, and we did Jim Wynorski as well, and Fred.
It
fits that kind of collection.
I'm well up for that. It's not a director. He's not a director I'm aware of. So thank you. I will look forward to watching that. And I mean that, actually, sincerely.
Wow.
No, true.
We We've got that on to
you. True that. Well, you know, I'll give you my unabridged opinions next time we speak, but...
Ask our mutual friend if he's got anything.
Oh, he will. I'm quite sure he'll have a vault. Yeah.
Okay, then.
Sorry, so Ed, go ahead.
Let's move into the main feature. And I'm going to go first with Bugonia, which is all the rage because at the moment it's just arrived on what's it on? Amazon? Yeah, I think it's on Amazon Prime. Yes, it is. Amazon Prime Video. And this is the latest project by Yorgos Lanthimos. And we've spoken before about Poor Things and Kinds of Kindness and The Favourite and The Killing of Sacred Deer and The Lobster and all those brilliant films.
Oh, I remember you raving about The Lobster, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really, really good set of films and he just has a really interesting approach to filmmaking, I think. Anyway, Bugonia kind of half relies... I'm sure that a lot of this has gone over my head, to be honest, in terms of the deep thinking, but it kind of relies on this thing called colony collapse disorder, which is a thing that it affects colonies of bees, where the worker bees all abandon the queen and leave the... Anyway, look it up if you want to. It's a very complicated thing. But we start off the film with our two main characters, who are beekeepers, and they are looking at these bees and they are tending to them, and then we get into this kind of whole area of looking into his basement. So the main character here is played by Jesse
Clemens,
sorry, I forgot his name. And he lives in this house with he's called Teddy, and he lives in this house with his cousin, and in the basement of the house they've got this whole walls littered with this kind of conspiracy theory about his mother, who's been taken into care by this company who's been led by this character called Michelle, who's running this big corporation. And this is where the whole colony collapse sort of thing comes in, because to cut the long story short, Teddy believes that the character Michelle is an alien and has come to Earth to collapse society via the actions of this corporation that's been set up for her. Okay,
you had me at alien. And conspiracy. This sounds brilliant.
Yeah. So what happens is that Teddy and his cousin decide they're absolutely convinced that Michelle is an alien. And so Michelle is played by Emma Stone, incidentally. And they decide that they're going to kidnap her. And they kidnap her and they take her to their cellar, the aforementioned cellar, and basically chain her up. And they start to question, or he starts to question her and to try to get her to cough and admit to the fact that she's an alien and there's a mothership lurking out there somewhere and that they've got plans to destroy the Earth and blah, blah, blah. And at times it's kind of quite funny. It's comic, but at other times it gets really nasty. He starts to basically abuse her. He reckons that her hair is the way in which she's able to communicate with the mothership. So he shaves her hair off. So it just gets more and more abusive, and he's completely convinced that Michelle is the alien. And then we move into another phase of the film about his mother and about the way in which the corporation has behaved. At one point, Michelle escapes, and we have to deal with that. It's just really complicated and really complex, and you've got to kind of keep up and understand a bit about the whole bee thing as well. So it the runtime flies past. It's really, really good. I really enjoyed it. Emma Stone and Jesse Plemons are just fabulous, the two of them. Their acting, their performances are really, really good. And the cinematography is great, and the sound and the direction and everything. It works really, really well. And then I found out, after I'd watched it, I found out that it was based on this other film from 2003, a Korean film called Save the Green Planet. And I tracked this down in the end on Daily Motion, which I'm not sure if I'm allowed to or not, but I did. I couldn't find it anywhere else. And sure enough, in a slightly more comic way, it kind of follows the same story, a very similar story, where the Michelle character is actually a man, but same thing, they kidnap him and put him in the cellar and they start to abuse him, and it all plays out in a very similar way. So I was pleased that I was able to watch both of the films and compare them, and it's based around that story. Apparently, Save the Green Planet was an original idea. It wasn't based on a book or anything. It was an original idea by these Korean filmmakers. And Bagonia and Yorgos have nicked the idea and made it into something more modern and up-to-date. So thoroughly recommended. It is, you know, a very recent film, but it is now on Amazon. So I think you should watch it. I'm guessing probably because it's so new, neither of you two have watched it.
I haven't. No. I've heard of it. I've heard people talking about it, but I haven't really taken on board what they've been saying. I get the sense that it's kind of generally very favourable stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Sounds really, really your bag.
Yeah, definitely. It's a good film. And I think it's worth trying to see the Korean one as well, because it's just it's a similar story. But it's just done slightly differently and strangely a bit more comically as well in places. Whereas Bagonia is mostly really serious and really scary and frightening and nasty. Whereas Save the Green Planet, I think they kind of inject a bit of humour into it through the nastiness as well. But there's just an edge to it, which is which is the case. Anyway, Gareth, you fancy it?
Yeah, I'll do. I'll certainly give it a go whenever it comes out. I'm quite intrigued by that Save the Green Planet. I just saw a review that said it's a mashup of Peter Jackson, David Cronenberg, and David Lynch. That sounds pretty intense. And it also features Alan Gilday, is it? Oh, no, sorry, that's Alan Fitter. Sorry, you get those two mixed up all the time. But yeah, that's quite Cronenberg, Jackson, and Lynch. That, wow, okay.
Yeah,
that sounds quite a heady brew, doesn't it?
Oh, it's all me. I'm off looking for it.
Cool. There you go.
Right, who's next? Let's go with Gareth.
Okay, I'll go quite quickly because everybody's seen this and I just wanted to hark on about it because I watched it again with my son and my wife and we just thought it was just a very good, nice movie, and that's the reputation that it has. Forrest Gump. I was wondering if it's still translated quite well today, if it still works, you know, how much sense it makes. Can you see through it? Do you watch it and cringe or whatever? But no, it's just so lovely. It's just so nicely laid out. And you could learn a bit from it. It makes you feel better about yourself. It makes you feel better about others and the world around you. It's generally...
Makes you feel better about shrimp.
Not shrimp, yes, and Bubba Gump.
Yep.
But you know, it obviously there's you can poke holes in it if you really want to, but as just a story that restores your faith in humanity, I think it works really well. And the performances are fantastic across the board, but I'd forgotten how damn good Gary Sinise is.
You beat me to it. That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
Yeah, and even just the little things, like whenever he's on top of the shrimp boat yelling at God, is this the best you got? You know, he's just so commanding and interesting. And I want to go away and find more Gary Sinise movies because I think that they need to either make them or they need to put them on some sort of time travel thing to go back and star in more movies because we don't have enough with him starring.
Is he in Usual Suspects? No.
No.
Oh, he was the guy in the wheelchair, was he?
Yeah.
He was.
Is he in Green Mile? Or something? Or, no. See, I can't think of anything else that he's in, and yet you obviously go,
oh, he's in Green Mile, yes. Sorry.
We watched,
and he's in Mission to Mars as well.
And did we watch a movie about a year ago, like a low budget film where he was in it?
Apollo 13?
Oh, right, he's great in that.
Of Mice and Men.
No, this was a sort weird little road movie with some. It'll come to me. Anyway, yes, he's always terrific. I can't think of him being bad in anything. Yes, there was some gangster, there's some revenge movie with that guy with the big teeth who's got in trouble recently. Guys, if you can remember what. Do you remember at the beginning of the movie, he's coming back from Vietnam and Jake Busey, I think. And then somebody kidnaps his wife and shoots his dad or daughter or something like that. And then the movie is them trying to find the kidnapped person. And do you remember the movie we're talking about here? Or I'm talking about?
No.
Jake Busey?
We spoke about it Midnight Clear on this show because I was a real fan back in the day. And I didn't realise he was in it. This is my takeaway from what you're saying here, Gareth. I'd moved away from your quest there.
No, it is correct. That's the right thing, because I was just babbling.
Midnight Clear, I'd completely forgotten about that film. It's really good. I might come back to that at some point. Sorry, back to you, Alan.
No, please, let's move on. I was just talking absolute cobblers.
Anyway, all right then, back to you then, Gareth.
Well, I don't really have too much to say. I've kind of lost my chain of thought, as per usual. But the special effects hold up quite well. You know, whenever you see some of the glances back, like the Lyndon B. Johnson and JFK and things like that, the digital effects don't work quite as well today, and you can see what they've done. Whereas I remember a big deal being made about it, and I think I watched a making of on ITV or something whenever it was coming out about it and how they did the feather as well at the start and the end of the film. And, you know, it's 2.5 hours long. I never clocked that either. I always thought this was a pretty lean 90-minuter where you're in and out without too much complaining. But no, it's much, much longer, and it does not overstay its welcome at all. You'd think that the character of Forrest Gump had been so lampooned over the years. You know, you hear kids yelling at each other as they're running across the park, run, Forrest, run, to be insulting to another kid. But whenever you hear it in the film, you're like, you know, yeah, I do like Forrest Gump. I do care about him. And, yeah, I don't think Tom Hanks has been better in a film. And I wish he would come back to comedy. I know this isn't a full comedy, but, you know, aside from The Terminal and, well, I suppose maybe Toy Story, he stayed away from comedy for a good long while. Yeah, we need to see him back. Anyway, you guys have both seen Forrest Gump and like it, don't you?
Yeah.
Yes.
Not excellent. For a long time, but yeah, definitely.
The Vietnam sequence was brilliant, I thought.
It did smack of the let's try and get every cliche of Vietnam in and all of the soundtrack.
it was very brutal, which, you know, sat very well against some of the other sort of schmaltzy moments of the movie. It had quite a broad tonal range, which I was expecting it to be just incredibly sentimental, but it was actually, it did have plenty of darkness in there as well, as Gary Sinise points out. You know, there's a lot of suffering and confusion in the movie, as well as, you know, some of the cheesier, softer bits. And the visual effects, I agree, are just absolutely terrific.
There was one moment, actually, that I just thought, it did have me welling up. And Tom Hanks was just phenomenal. There's a point where Robin Wright Penn tells him that, you know, this is your son. And you see Tom Hanks taking a step back and just tears appearing in his eyes as he's as he asks the question, is he smart or something like that, or is
oh he, yes, is he like me? In other words, yeah.
And yeah. She says no, and you can see the all his hair standing on end and things like that as he's just combating all of this emotion.
Yeah.
Whenever you see Tom Hanks do that, you just think, flip, no one else.
Yeah. That is something else, isn't it? Yeah.
It's just really like Jack Nicholson doing that or something like that, or Harrison Ford bungling his way through that. No way. Tom Hanks was perfect.
No, the man can act, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. He collected his wages that week, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And lastly, Alan, what have you brought to the main feature?
Not a whole lot that's new, chums. I've continued to watch Pluribus and my enthusiasm for it has increased rather than dwindled. It's absolutely brilliant. As I said to you before, terrifying, thought-provoking, hilarious in equal measure, and just brilliantly executed. So really, really good. And then had I mentioned last time we were talking that I'd been watching Jason King off the back of the other 60s and 70s shows? I think I did say to you last time, yeah?
Well, maybe you did, but you didn't.
All right, Well, I'll keep it short, but essentially Jason King is a character played by Peter Wingard.
Yeah.
Who was absolutely, in this show, flamboyant, sort of bon vivant. He's supposed to be a novelist, and then he is so brilliant in writing his novels that MI5 and the CIA employ him on a freelance basis to go off and investigate beautiful women and crimes around the world. And it's absolutely preposterous. He's as somebody said, there's more meat on a butcher's pencil. The man is so thin. But he wears all these very, very flamboyant fitted 70s suits. Massive hair, big moustache, ludicrous looking guy, always smoking. Yes, we did talk about this because I said like he was always in in a silk kimono and a scarf and a pipe and sunglasses on the beach drinking scotch and chatting up birds. Anyway, it's
not a pipe, a cigarette in a holder, wasn't it?
Yeah, that is most of the time. Yes, that's right. But it's just so deliciously bonkers and kind of anachronistic now. But the episode I watched last night finished with him surrounded by three hotties who were all taking turns to kiss him and pour him drinks as he crafted the next few sentences of his magnus opus. And I'm just thinking, my gosh, they don't make them the same. And he's got this ludicrously plummy accent. And it's all just quite wonderful. Now, in one of the episodes, he also plays this Bulgarian mafioso in disguise, and then you realize actually what a gifted actor he was, because you sort of take him to be Jason King, but when he plays this other character, you realize the range the guy has is terrific. And he was also one of the leads in the acclaimed, I think, 1961 horror film The Innocents, which we talked about earlier in the year, which is absolutely brilliant film as well. So anyway, and he lived to a ripe old age of in his 90s. Peter Wingard was really terrific.
He got involved in some controversy, didn't he?
Yes, he sort of disgraced himself by he had a sort of like a bit of a 80s pop star detente in a gentleman's lavatory with some chap. And that was very much frowned upon. It was very much frowned upon at the time. And so he was kind of...
King then?
No, not very Jason King. But he was also married to Vivian Leigh, I think, or they were going out for a long time. And also it was... Anyway, the big British TV producer, Hugh Grade, was it, or somebody? Anyway, he was commissioning the show. He didn't like the character, didn't really like him, but his missus really fancied the pants off him. And it was as a result of his sex appeal that she had sort of cajoled her husband into commissioning the series. So anyway, it's dated 70s, and even by my boorish standards, it makes me cringe at times because of its chauvinism and stuff, but it's good fun and it's colourful and daft and very flamboyant and enjoyable. So there you have it. Ted, yep. You do remember this from back in the day, don't you?
Very clearly. We used to watch it every week when it came out, me and my sister. My sister really fancied the pants off him.
There you go.
And, we used to tune in every time, and it was just good fun. A bit like the Persuaders and the Pretenders and all of that.
Yes.
It was just a thing of the era, wasn't it?
And very much so.
Peter Wingard was, he was just the bee's knees at one time for us.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's good. And I'm only coming to this, you know, very late in the day, so it's nice.
Right, okay then. Assuming we're done with that section, we can head to coming soon, Gareth.
Okay, well, we'll start in Norway with Kraken. A marine biologist is doing research on a fish farm when she encounters several strange occurrences. Along with the brutal deaths of two teenagers, all signs point to the deep fjord. Can there be more to the depths than the eye can see? Kraken has been out for a while, I think, in Norway. I think it probably was out in the summer or the early summer, maybe. And it's getting a worldwide release on February the 6th. And word is that it's really quite good. So I'm dead excited about this. I know my wife will be very excited about it. She's a big Kraken fan. She is Team Undersea Crypto stuff.
I thought it was pronounced Kraken. Do you call it Kraken?
I do call it Kraken because that's how it's pronounced.
Is it?
I'm with Ted on this one.
Okay.
Nope. I've done that before. My wife has corrected me many times, saying, no, it's not Kraken, it's Kraken, and it's just drummed into me.
Okay.
You say potato, you know what I say.
This looks great, though.
Honestly, Alan, do you go around? Can I have two potatoes, please? Would you like your potatoes hard boiled or roasted?
This looks great. This looks great. Shut up, you two. You know, the creature in the fjord. What's there not to love? I also love the whole Scandinavian accent and intonation in their speech and their voice. It's just great. It's a bit like the way that Koreans. Well, it's not the same, but it's just a really, when you watch a Korean film, you hear the way they speak to each other. It's just really lovely. Really, really good. So I'm looking forward to that. Kraken. I'm looking forward to Kraken. Waking the Kraken. Yeah.
All right. Next up is Hazel's Heart. In March 1920, three children become lost while in a white-out blizzard. For the next 25 hours, they must fight to survive while their father leads a desperate hunt to find them before it is all too late. Now, everybody loves films set in the snow.
Yay.
And being really cold. And there's nothing better than sitting in your warm, comfy armchair with a couple of snacks and nibbles, watching other people having to work their way through very, very cold environments, especially whenever things are happening like this. I've got a funny feeling Ted was all over this.
Yeah. I love the snowy environment. Just what you described, sitting with your glass of brandy and your cigar and roaring fire while you watch a film or something like Fargo or something where everyone's freezing their bollocks off. It's great. I did think that this is based on a true story, apparently, and I did begin to think as it went on that it might turn a bit soppy, but then if it's kind of heartstring territory, then and that's true, then fair enough, I suppose. But it did feel a little bit like it was might head that way, Alan.
Yeah, I agree. It didn't particularly hook me. I have to say, I'm sure it could be good, but it didn't jump out at me. Yes, and it had the potential to be a bit, as you say, sort of soppy.
Yep.
Let's give it a go and we'll see.
Yep.
Okay, all right. I'm just noticing there's only four trailers here.
Oh, dear.
Five.
What a disaster.
There was a wee sci-fi one I threw in for Alan because I thought he might enjoy it, but I can't remember what it's called now. All right. The next one is Runaway. This is a new mini series that'll be arriving on Netflix on January 1st. Simon's perfect life is shattered when his daughter Paige runs away. Found strung out in a park, Simon's search into the dangerous underworld where an act of violence rocks his life. This sounds, yeah, it's one of those urban domestic thrillers with James Nesbitt, where he and your girl from Gavin and Stacey. What's her name? I can't see it here in front of me. What's occurring, that girl? Mm-hmm. But yes, it's Minnie Driver's in there too. And it just looks like a good old fashioned, I'd say, an ITV drama that's appearing on Netflix. Yeah. Alan, do you like the look of this?
I did not. I thought it looked cheap and predictable. And, you know, I think the middle-aged or late middle-aged cusp of old man going off to find his daughter stuff is sort of being, I think, has been done. So, yeah, it didn't seem original, and it actually didn't seem particularly... It didn't seem to have anything particularly fresh or a USP about it, and it looked cheap to me. I thought the trailer just looked cheap.
That's so why we'll I said ITV drama, because they film
around. Cheap. Yeah, it's not like $100 million movie, but it's not to say it mightn't be good. You know, Mr. Nesbitt is good at what he does, and I'm sure it's serviceable. But it didn't look interesting to me. What did you think, Ted?
You've given it ITV. I'm giving it Channel 5 afternoon drama.
Okay.
Yeah, it just doesn't look particularly great, and it looked very much like a Channel 5 production. Having said that, as the trailer went on, it was clear that there's a few bits of grisly crime going on, so it may be okay. And I can't not watch it because I just love Minnie Driver, and whatever she's in, I just need to watch it, I'm afraid. So,
do you find you? Like, you find her attractive, yeah?
Yeah, definitely.
I never did. I find her quite weird looking. Mm. Yeah. But then I suppose
ever since Circle of Friends, and I never looked back. I fell in love with her in Circle of Friends, and that was it. I was hooked.
Oh, nice one. Cool beans.
Well, yes, I agree with you, Alan. It annoys me that this is just another of those domestic ones. If only it turned out he was actually a secret, spy or something like that.
Yeah, an alien.
To take them down. Or an alien, yes.
Well, he does get arrested at one point.
Right, right.
In the trailer,
he gets arrested all the time.
Yeah, he gets dragged off in a police car, so you never know.
It's the coppers were in on it, mate. Goes all the way to the top.
Ruth Jones is the name of the girl who's from Gavin and Stacey. All right, the last one here is also on Netflix as well, and it's a feature film called The Great Flood. I'm not going to attempt to say what it is in its native language, but it has a different title. A disastrous great flood sweeps the planet. The planet, not just like a tsunami or anything, but the planet, because this is post-apocalyptic tip. On what may be the last day on Earth, a desperate fight ensues to save a child from a flooding apartment.
Hold on. So there's a leak in an apartment. And they've
yes, so let's, there is. And they've got
let's spend our time.
Insurance
and, save everybody, and then maybe we'll be okay to deal with the global tsunami. I'm not sure I follow this.
It should be good fun.
It doesn't really matter because it's a Korean action adventure disaster movie, and actually they're really good at this stuff. They do it well. Maybe not technically well, but they grab you and they make an adventure out of it. And I'm all for this. I think it'll be really, really good. And the trailer makes it look like the effects are great fun.
Ted, there is, theoretically, apparently, there's a parallel universe where an alternate Ted loves religion and hates Korean cinema.
Bollocks.
Apparently that's true.
Up your ass.
There you go. Right, so anyway.
He's also suave and debonair.
Anyway, I thought this looked exactly like a Korean, you know, sort of disaster movie. I'm not really interested in this one. No.
Piss off then.
I will, mate. I will. Just you watch, you know. Yeah. So, right. Yeah. There you have it.
Well, did you find your last one, Gareth?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Yeah, I am good.
We'll do that next time, maybe, then. So we've just got time for the final curtain. Someone else has snuck in there while I wasn't looking. So there's two. Gareth?
Yes, I referenced it earlier on in the show, but we'll go with Kari Haruyuki Tagawa has passed away, who is a well-known Japanese actor who has appeared in many, many films, from License to Kill to Mortal Kombat, Planet of the Apes, Tekken, even provided a voice on DuckTales. He's in Lost in Space, that newer TV series, remember the one on Netflix a few years ago? Mm-hmm. And the Librarians TV show, he's in that too. 47 Ronin, he was in that. The one with Keanu Reeves. Once you see his face, you'll go, wow, I remember him. Memoirs of a Geisha. That was
Robert Mitchum in that picture. You know, like a sleepy-eyed, I don't give a hoot, you know, tough guy type thing. Just class presence.
Yeah. There's a film I can think of that I can't remember which one it is. And it's kind of sticking in my mind, peeping its head around the corner going, you're not going to work out what I am. But he's the Phantom. Got it. Yep. He's in the Phantom.
Well done. Well done. And I remember him from, he was my favorite character in Man in the High Castle. He played this sort of Japanese prime minister or, you know, way up in the Japanese cabinet. But he had an alternate life that he accessed through meditation and stuff. And his character had such dignity and presence. He was absolutely magnificent in it. And I'm very sorry to see that he is gone.
Yeah. Quite early as well. He passed away at 75.
Yes.
You imagine his fitness probably would have been very high because he was always an action star. And there was one film that popped up there that I remember starting to watch called Showdown in Manila with Casper Van Dien, and it was kind of on Mark Dacascos. It was a direct-to-video Expendables knockoff, to be honest. And it was actually really quite good because they put together a decent collection of dependable video action stars. And it was nice to see him included in that because he absolutely is the right person to go in there. Ted, obviously you know him as well.
I can't honestly say I do, but as is quite often the case with these situations, when you start to look down the filmography, you start to say, yeah, I've seen him in that. Could no way have put a name to him, but and the Man in the High Castle, did you mention that, Alan? You were a fan of that, weren't you?
Yeah, I loved it, yeah. I mean, it was hard to work out what was going on, especially in the second season, but I just atmosphere and the art direction of it, I just thought was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And plus I had a major crush on the female lead as well.
Ah. That certainly helped.
Sorry to lower the tone, but
but yeah, tons and tons. The first is kind of the mid 1980s when he first started working by the looks of it. But yeah, tons of work.
Yeah. The next one I just found out about as we started the show, and I couldn't respond because I was my jaw had hit the table because I'm a big fan of Josh Becker, who passed away at the age of 67, and obviously I'm a big Bruce Campbell fan, so that kind of it ekes into that. Josh was another of the very approachable crew from Michigan who made a lot of movies over the years. He was probably best known for his work on Hercules and Xena because he made a number of the episodes of those two popular TV shows. But he made a lot of sci-fi channel movies. He made a lot of movies with Bruce Campbell itself, like Alien Apocalypse, and he did one with Stephen Baldwin that was terrible, called Harpies. I don't think he would mind anyone saying that his crap movies were crap, because he's the kind of guy who would be brutally honest about it, because right. whenever he made a good film, he made a bloody good film. Wow. If you go back to 1997, he made Running Time with Bruce Campbell, which is a bit like that Alfred Hitchcock film Rope, where it's all shot in one shot, yeah. you know. It, the Bruce Campbell's character gets out of prison and then attempts to rob the laundry system, and it just follows him everywhere. And it's beautifully laid out. It's so well done. It's artistic. It's striking. It's it just goes to show what a damn good filmmaker that man was. I had the pleasure of speaking to him via email a couple of times because he's got a really big blog, and every day he would do daily updates to it, where he'd rant about this, that, and everything else. And he was the one I found out that Scott Spiegel had passed away a good few years ago. Earlier this year, actually, that was. But he passed away at the age of 67, and I'm a wee bit dumbfounded by it, because that means over the next few days I won't be getting that email of his, because he sent up for email updates, and you get one every day from him. And
those
I haven't actually noticed. I got one last week, so it's a bit wow. And you really get to know someone whenever they go to that level. And sometimes you just think, oh, I can't read it. You know, he's talking about Trump here, so I'll move on. But then whenever Scott passed away, he started telling stories about his childhood and making films way back with Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell. And going on and getting Stryker's War, or Thou Shalt Not Kill, Except, made. And how Hercules came about, because he did the pilot for Hercules, the four TV movies to start the show. And he was incredible. He wrote Bill Lustig's hit list, which was, he was actually uncredited for that. I hadn't realized that, but I knew he'd written it. And there's a little movie that he put out a few years ago called If I Had a Hammer, which is a very musically twisted film, and then one with Ted Raimi and Bruce Campbell called Lunatics, A Love Story, back in 1991. And that was a beautiful little independent comedy that was so good, so well made, and it had no budget. And I think actually Bruce Campbell, being the producer, decided to play two roles in it because they couldn't afford an actor for both roles. So he pops up in two different roles. But the climax in that film, involving spiders on top of a building, was just a creative masterpiece. It's not the greatest film in the world, don't get me wrong, but it just has some spectacular special effects that they managed to put together for the end of that film, and it just looks so good. And it's one of those films that, you know, Ted Raimi is terrific in the lead. It's well worth checking out if you really want to see a wee bit of independent, low-budget 90s comedy from America. Oh, it's terrific. Mm-hmm. He will be sorely missed by me. I'm quite upset that he's gone, to be honest.
I didn't know the fella, but when I saw the notes there, I kind of knew, oh gosh, this is going to hit Gareth quite hard. And so I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry. I know you're not related or anything like that, but you love somebody, you love somebody, whether it's in a sort of professional capacity from a distance, but you love somebody's work, you know, and they've contributed a lot to your life. That's really difficult. Sorry. Yeah.
Well, I think you can jump onto YouTube and watch Running Time there. I'm pretty sure it's on there, but it's definitely not on Blu-ray and DVD. And I think that would be a fitting way for anyone who wants to know why I'm banging on about him.
No, we get it. Film.
And Alan, you've seen it, haven't you? No?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I've seen bits of Xena and some of the other, you know, stuff of that ilk. But no, I don't think I have.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Ted, have you ever heard of him or knew any of these films?
I'm afraid I don't, no. Sorry. But I do plug into your Bruce Campbell thing, because I was, you know, aware of the whole chain of stuff you were doing on him, with the with your mate, who I can't remember his name either.
Simon.
Hey?
Simon.
Simon, was it? Okay. And yeah, I'm floundering for words now, because I've not heard of him, and I don't know any of the films or anything in the list. Oh. And move on.
No worries. Well, he passed away at the age of 67. It was very sad, and thoughts are with his family and friends. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay, I think we're done for this show. Podhub UK, don't forget, is where you'll get links to all the stuff that we do in the group of audio podcasts. TedSalmon.com if you get lost. GarethMiles.com if you want to see what Gareth is up to. ProjectorRoom.co.uk is our website. And other than that, we're in MeWe. So links in the show notes for all of that stuff in ProjectorRoom.co.uk and in your podcatcher. And we'll be back again in 2 weeks' time with our 200th show. And hopefully we'll have something a bit Christmassy for you. So we'll catch you then. So hopefully you can join us again in the Projector Room.